accession number 18357, Reel 3.
Tom Carroll, Reel 3. So there must have been a point where the resistance group or the resistance area was liberated by the Allied troops.
Yes. And that was then intensely political as far as the French were concerned. And they had nothing, no more interest in us at all. They were struggling for their own position and what could happen to France. And looking back on my own view, of course, was that the only people that I saw who were a danger to the Germans or were the communists, and everybody else was. I learned then, I've had it confirmed since then, there's a respectable French people. They call the bourgeois, whatever, the dentist, the doctor, the teacher. Everybody who had any money or any position in France valued that more than they did their country or their loyalty to their country or anything else. And it was the poorer ones and the communists who really were hated the Germans. I'm sorry to say that, but that's one of my experience.
And was it the American troops who came in?
Yes.
What impression did
they came up from the south of France. Came up. They were great. they were great. And I liked them. Yes.
In what way were they so great?
They were fun. You listened to. They were not. They were not sticking them out at all. They were really alert. Not very competent, but they were alert, and I just happened to enjoy them. They were people I liked.
In what way were they not so competent?
They were just not. I don't know why I just say that. They were all over the place. They had a tendency to play games, play. Oh, I'm a soldier, sort of thing. No. And I'm a soldier, and they behave. I like them. It's hard to say why, but they were good. They were free. Much freer than the English, the regular army. Of course, the territorial army, the conscript army, is different. The British conscript army were much better.
Now, we were discussing off the record a little while back about the question of decorations and citations for the Jedburgh teams in France.
Well, mine came down, they used to say in the army once, it came down the rations. Not that we had any rations come down, but in the First World War they used to say the citation came down the rations. Well, because they were all bloody brave, a lot of them. Then there would be so many MCs to award it to this lot and so many that lot, and dish it out amongst yourselves, boys. And that happened. That happened to me too.
What was the setup like as far as organisation of SOE back in England? From what?
No idea. Not the faintest idea. We were launched from Baker Street. And we were not allowed to know, well, quite rightly so. We didn't know anything about the briefing we had to come off was just rather simple. I can't remember much about it, but it was all. But because when you go behind the lines, you must not know anything, well, and quite rightly so. But I never did know anything.
But when you got back to England, I think you were given another SOE assignation.
Well, that was a bit of a lark. I'll tell you how that happened. We were thrown out by de Gaulle, and I was bloody angry about that. Anyway, especially that car I'd lost. And when we arrived back in England, I went to the War Office, and I met some staff officer, and he said, he's very kind, he said, well, you've done a marvellous job. Nice, which I had. Now then, what regiment do you want to do? What job do you want to do now? What regiment do you want to go to? So I said to him, well, I'm not very good at regimental surgery. Have you read my reports? I asked him, have you read my confidential reports? And he said, no. I said, well, I think before we carry this conversation go any longer, you ought to read some of them. They're pretty bad. So he said, he did. I got them out. He said, yes, I see the point. I said, some of them are quite good, aren't they? Yes. He said, some of them are very good, some of them are awful. I said, it's definitely, those confidential reports were absolutely right. Now, it's really no good me going back to the regimental surgery again. I'm not good at it. I haven't done it for the, during the war. And so, you know, well, what else can I do? You think of something else. He said, there's nothing else. So I said, well, let's have a look at resistance. He said, there was no resistance whatever. I said, well, there's a war going on out east, isn't there? He said, he said, there's no resistance there. And then I recalled, I said to a lovely story about about shoe salesmen. Two shoe salesmen were sent to Nigeria to sell shoes. And when they came back, one said, I still could go to Nigeria, they don't wear shoes. And the other one came back and said, God, Nigeria, marvellous, nobody's yet bought any shoes. I want to go there and sell them some. Now, that was, I remember quoting that story to him, and whoever he was. And I said, well, but why isn't there resistance in Burma? He said, well, there isn't. I said, well, why don't we go out and have a look and see? So we did that. I got a gang up, a gang of chaps up. We got on a boat, went out there, took 3 or 4 weeks, I don't know how long it took, going through the Suez Canal on a boat, no flying. And we got out there at Calcutta and met a man called, he just died lately. Oh dear, oh dear, 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 dear. I know him so well, I'll come back to his name now. But he was marvellous. He was my staff officer. And we worked out with him a plan. And he said, and he had some Burmans, and I've got a photograph of one here called Tantun, and a letter from him. I'll show you later. Tunjo, I mean, it's called Tunjo. Anyway, I had a word with him, and I said, why aren't they resisting? He said to me, they're all drinking gin and Kimberley and similar. And I said, no, where? All those people who could have helped the resistance in Burma. Never got off acid. They were drinking gin and some. So I said, well, he'd had some Burmans who he could trust, and he formed a little team around me, and with Johnny Fox, John Cox, I think, came with me. Or was it Bill Brown? John Cox came with me, and an Englishman. I found myself leading this gang to go out. I originated the idea, and when I got to India, they asked me if I spoke Burmese. I said not a word, but I didn't speak much French either. And so we set up an operation. And I think I better take a rest here because that's so interesting. That was where I really enjoyed the war. It was successful when I went to Burma.
Just before we go on to Burma, you said that you went out to the Southeast Asia with a gang of people.
Well, not a gang of people. A few of us also, when I mooted the idea that we would transfer our skills into Burma, other people rallied around. Bill Brown, John Cox, John Sharp, who I met not long ago. And so on, and they came round, and I was the first one to go in to try it out. And I reckon that was a bit foolish of me, to be truthful now, looking back on it. I reckon that those Englishmen who are drinking gin and similar were probably right. But still, they did speak Burmese. And when we got back, they knew the name of the elephants in the area. So that's how well they knew Burma, which I'd never been east of Gibraltar before.
So how did you actually make the drop into Burma?
That was interesting. Dakota. And Now, I had together a gang of some Burmans, a team of Burmans, and one young man was with me called Dunjaw. And I've got a letter from him which I received not long ago, a year ago, and I have his photograph there. And he was a youngster, even younger than I was. I thought I was pretty young then, but he was younger, he was quite young. And he's not very good at blowing his nose either, but he was highly intelligent. And all those Burmans were pretty bright. And they were treated by the Brits quite differently to the way I treated them. I treated them as my equal, completely. But later on, to show how badly I was treated, when we did come back together, and I'm now hopping now, but I'm going to make my point. When we came back together, they separated me from my team, Burmans. I said, hey, hold it. I'm going to stay with them. He said, no, you know, they tried, because I was a white officer and they were Burmans. The people back in, it was in Calcutta then, when I flew back in, were determined to separate, and I was determined they were not going to separate me. And they couldn't see. They succeeded in separating from them. And, you know, they went to one lot of quarters and we went to another officer's mess. I found it intolerable. But that was typical of those times. Of course, you can't blame them, I suppose. But I didn't understand it. You know, I didn't understand it. I was very angry. Very angry about that. So, there we are. But that was the relationship, of course, the British. They had no right to be to continue in Burma. You see, let me talk in general about Burma, what my experience was in the end of it. The end of it was that the British officers there were still back their old tricks of running an empire, and they assumed that when the war was over, that then they beat the Japs, they would once again take over Burma. I learned in very quickly that wasn't what the Burmans were assuming. The Burmans were assuming that they were free, and the British were openly saying that they had a list of people who were traitors. Well, I said that no, they're not traitors. They didn't like the British, and then they didn't like the Japanese, and they said, and these are the people I recruited. And they couldn't understand that. Now, the only person eventually who understood it too completely was Mountbatten, who later on, went down at Camden. I got to know Mountbatten. He called me and wanted to know about what I'd done and thing. And he understood. And he, when I said the attitude the Brits had was quite contrary to the reality of Burma. And he understood that, and he said to me, I got on very well with him. And I lived in the same mess as my Mountbatten. And he said to me, what's the name of the governor? Oh, my God, I've got the governor who was expected to go back. He said, Mountbatten said, over my dead body, will he go back? I understand what you mean. I said, they're not traitors. They are Burmans. And they've been fighting for Burma, and that's what they're... And when I was with them, we felt the same. And now, I'll tell you now, I'm not going to give you chronological order in long. I can't do that. But I'll tell you the ideas they came, the thoughts came into me. We were at one stage early on, after our drop, in trouble. We had nowhere to go, nothing was happening. We were given a list of Burmese government judges and important Burmese people who we were told by those people in Simla would be given sort of support, and they were very pro-British and support. When we contacted them, they were the game door like France. They were the respectable people, and they were not going to stick their neck out at all. And once again, as in France, there was no support coming from them, and we were in trouble. We were sitting in the jungle, my little team of people were in trouble. I should get that photograph to enjoy. It's right around there somewhere. I saw it when you heard you were coming. I found it. This is what I had, and I said to him, we were up in the jungle, and the jungle is such that it has a canopy of trees. You can't see very far. It's one of these fascinating, it was a canopy, it was quite mountainous, hilly, but it was this canopy of trees. We heard some shooting going on down below, and I said to Enjoy, I said, hey, there's shooting there down there. If they're shooting, one of the lot could be on our side. Can you get out there? Can you sort of figure out, sort of see what's going on? And see what perhaps we can team up. So he came back with two people. One was Pinothea, and he was in his yellow robe, saffron robe. The other one was, I'll tell you his name in a minute. The other one was a robber chieftain. And he was a really rough one. And they both got drunk and were firing at each other. And they were having a party. They were absolutely drunk, the both of them. And they began to cook on and back, come to see us. And then, in the conversation we talked, and we heard, or we told them, this little story will come through later, that I was Irish. I was made. Because they regarded themselves as the Irish of the East, and they were going to get free of the Brits or of the English just as they are in the same way. I was made. We had that team from that moment on. They were on my side, and we had a ball. And that resistance was we really had a ball. We had arms dropped to us. I think we eventually had about 2,000. It was a hell of a lot of arms dropped to us. And we were road villages, and sometimes I got into trouble. I tell you one of my techniques. This is where my imagination works so good. We were in the mountains like that, and in the paddy fields. Well, the paddy fields, when men were my size, my legs, my feet, was bigger in those days than I am now, proportionally bigger. People were my height to a penny now, but going back now, but not a year, so not. And when I walked through a paddy field like that, my footprint was enormous. So that wasn't very clever. So I used to have somebody walking behind me treading it in, so that there was nothing left there. But my real trick, when I told the people like that came back, they were furious. I got teams of small boys. I think we had three teams of small boys. Eight, nine, ten. And I had a screen which they were defending. And I said, when you see a Japanese, get a piece of mud out and sling it at him. Said, show your ass to him and run back and tell him where they are. So this screen went. So I was able to progress through Burma with this screen of boys, which I used to relieve. And had one screen, and put another lot out. And of course, it was marvellous. I didn't believe, you see. I didn't carry, you asked me, I didn't carry rifles and things. I think I had a pistol. I think, yes, I had a pistol, and that was all I carried. I because I think that if I got to that stage, I'd finished anyway. The thing is not to get caught up. I was very strong on that, not to be caught. My safety relied on not being caught, not in having a row with them.
You weren't to tell me earlier, but you got a bit diverted about how you dropped into Burma in the first place.
Yes, well, yes, I met. We walked out. This, when I got to the plane, they said, "Yeah." I said, "Where's the hole?" They said, "No hole. You walk out the door." I said, "I never walked out the door." She said, "Oh, you just walk out." So when I walked out of the door, I sort of tried to say, "How do you get out?" So I went out, both leg and arm up, and sort of get here because the wind got hold of my leg and arm and started twisting. And before the parachute, time to open the parachute, started twisting. Which is, and I could see it up there, I was twisting, and that game was embarrassing. And I pulled it with all my strength to push it apart. And when I came back, obviously that it did open, otherwise I wouldn't be here. But it did open, and when I came back, I told him the parachute man, he said, "That's the last thing you should have done. You were sending those twists up to the parachute. You should have not done that." Well, of course, you don't think about that. I kicked myself. Not realizing that, but no, you don't. And I think that was the time when we dropped into the sort of bamboo, sort of grass grows 7 foot tall. And we dropped in there. They went to the mental reception committee, actually there was somewhere around there. But it was dropping in there at night. And luckily I had an idea of where the stars were, where the reception committee was, and something was going in my mind. Anyway, when you land, you literally are blind. This is Stephen. You could go, I was going and bashing down the grass, then walking back, and you could never see over it. It was all 7 foot tall. And they're thinking, what do? You shout or do something? I don't know. So, to actually, we teamed up. We got us all together again. I think it's through sheer luck. I think we all had a sense to go towards the jungle. This was in plain paddy field, old fat jungle tour. And we all had to go. We all luckily walked towards the hill and then met up again.
How big a team was this?
This was Sergeant Sharp, that radio operator. He was brilliant. Johnny Cox, and myself, and about four bums. Tunjaw was the man who was the young boy who leader of the Burmans. Seven.
And whereabouts in Burma was this?
Arakan.
And do you know about which month in 45 it was?
No, not a fixed idea. I really haven't. I've often thought about that. I hardly know it's 45, except I know it's the end of one war and the beginning of another.
Did the team have a name, do you know?
Oh, yes. Weasel.
And once you got to the reception committee, were you able to start operating with them?
No, I don't know what happened to that. We seem to have lost them or something, or didn't work, or just, I don't know what happened there. I really don't know what happened. I know that we got more or less lost, and what managed to get it going was me suggesting that if two people were firing down below, one might be on our side. That was a typical way my mind always worked that way. That was one occasion when it paid, because if we hadn't done that, we would have been finished. We were isolated, and there was no hope of surviving until the armies came, unless we found some sort of get-together.
Do I understand that you had the rank of lieutenant colonel at the time?
Well, I promoted, lieutenant came with my second operation. My second operation was such that, with the context from the first one...
The second operation into Burma?
Into Burma. Well, like from the contacts there, we had contacts going up into Burma. I made my name, and they realised this is serious. What I was doing was able to be serious, because I got some very good airstrikes organised. We did quite well. But when the second time I went in, we went into Tunjaw. And there were two people. One was the secretary to the cabinet, the Japanese cabinet, and the other was Minister of Transport and Commodities. And they had been in the Japanese-Burmese government. It came out of Rangoon. And Dongu it was. And then they came out to meet us, and that was all arranged. That was where my staff officer, whose name I know as well as my own, had arranged this, and he was first class. He arranged this meeting, and then we then grouped together. And what was your question?
I was asking you if you were a lieutenant.
Yes. Then because I was dealing with such important people. I said, look here, I can't do this. By that time I was a major, you see. And I'd got myself promoted to major. I said, look, I really can't do this as a major. I've got to be a colonel to deal with these people. So they made me a colonel. I've always said that I promoted myself colonel. Nobody believes it, but it was true. I had to be a colonel to be there. That's how I was. I still, people, when I left the army, had a good laugh. I was still really young for colonel when I left the army. I was really young, of course, to be a colonel.
What was the main difference between the Arakan area and the Tongo area?
The operation, you mean? Well, the first one was... I lost my name, well, never got my name, with the people who were in the, similar, the gin drinkers and those people. And they didn't like me for what I was doing. I proved that you could run a good resistance. And the first one was a bloody good resistance. We could invite people to see the show, and we'd invite people to sit on a hill and watch a Japanese village being bombed. That well organized. And my staff officer was so brilliant back in Calcutta. I'm embarrassed that I can't recall his name now. He was such a marvelous guy. He was the one who I had total faith in him. And we did very well. We had a lot of arms. We certainly had the Japanese embarrassed. Now, let me tell you this. When the armies were coming through, this became interesting, because the armies were coming through, and at the time, they found, they knew the names of the people I was cooperating with, particularly the two, the robber chieftain and the priest, and one or two others. But their names that we had reported back, because we had a radio system, which was brilliant. This man, John Sharp, was marvellous. He was English, really, and I still know him to this day. He was marvellous. He used to sling a bit of wire up and into the trees with the end of a stone, and he used to wind up a thing, and he used to get back to Calcutta regularly. And, well, there'll be a big story on that later on, but he would do that. He wouldn't do anything else. He was 16 years. When I said, "Will you do anything?" He said, "No, I'm operating the radio, that's all." They refused point blank to do anything else but that. But God, he was good at it. And now, when we were overtaken, we were told to come back that these people were to be arrested on site. Oh, you know, so the people who were my people. Their name was listed there as traitors. Well, far from traitors. The unbaggers drinking far as I was concerned, the gin drinkers and similar were traitors. My guys were marvellous. And they were. So, and that was happened, and I was told that. So I said, I called in, and they got hold of a walrus. You know, a walrus is a one-engine pusher. It's a boat with a couple of wings on it. And someone came and landed on the Arakan River and picked me up there and took me back to Cox's Bazaar, where I met not General Slim, I met him later on. Not now, so... one of the generals. Anyway, I said, "Look here, these people, I've been told, these are my people, and I've been told to arrest them on site." And he said, "Yes." So I said, "Well, I don't want that. I mean, they've been down to Marvelously." He said, "Well, that's an order." So I said, "Well, if we got to talk, I'm not going back. I told him, if I don't go back, they would